Everyone in the past couple of days has been talking about the system software that they're running on their supercomputers and their data centers and their clusters. I'm going to talk about the system software that I want to run on my toaster. So when we usually think of the computing landscape, it ranges from up here at the top, we have big giant shared memory supercomputers. They're really expensive. There are only a few of them. And down here is the embedded world. The embedded world are things like iPhones and iPads and stuff like that, right? Well, it turns out that misses a huge chunk of the computing world. It misses these. This is a microcontroller, and they are absolutely everywhere. So while there might only be like a thousand or so big supercomputers in the world, maybe there are a billion iPhones, but there are 10 billion 32-bit microcontrollers. And down at the 4, 8, and 16-bit ranges, well, I don't even think you can figure out how many there are. They're embedded in everything between the remote control to your television set to the key for your car, smart cards. They're everywhere. And they're basically impossible to program. So vendors provide really complicated compilers, really complicated compiler tool chains, but there's absolutely no runtime support on these things. Let's say you want to write a file to disk. Well, too bad. You have to do it yourself. Implement a file system. Maybe you can find one online. You want to allocate some memory. Well, you're going to need to bring your own malloc implementation. Just about everything is programmed in hand-coded interrupt handlers, and that sort of gets into the hairy world of concurrent systems in C, which I think all the programming languages people here have decided is like impossible. And if simple things, like you want to print something out to a console. Well, you don't have a console on your microwave. So you just have to futz with it until it works. So why isn't there runtime system support? Well, you might think that these devices, they're just not capable of running a runtime system. But it turns out that's not really true. Yeah, they don't have a lot of storage. We've got 64 kilobytes of RAM on the device we're using. Generally no more than a half a megabyte of storage. But they're actually pretty fast, anywhere from 50 to 100 megahertz. So they're a whole lot faster than computers were when people started coming to Usenix. So we're at the point now where we can really think about putting real runtime systems on these deeply embedded devices. And people have started this. 10 years ago, there were Java card applications where people tried to port JVM to 8 and 16-bit smart cards. And this actually sort of kind of worked. More recently, there have been open source projects. There are two of them right now. One's called eLua. It's a port of, obviously, Lua to a 32-bit microcontroller. There's another one called Python on a Chip. These are both open source sort of community development efforts, and they both work to some degree, but they haven't been really seriously studied. So we're throwing our own hat in the ring with something we call OWL. OWL is a complete development tool chain for microcontrollers, specifically for this microcontroller. This is a 32-bit ARM. It has 96 kilobytes of RAM and 256 kilobytes of flash. OWL is based on a collection of open source components, including the aforementioned Python on a chip. But we deliver a complete tool chain. There are programmers that run on desktops. There are profilers. There's an interactive prompt where I can type commands. We have a whole lot of features with this, and we've built a lot of systems with it. We've built a lot of embedded applications. We describe all of these in the paper, but today I want to talk about two particular features of OWL. Now, I picked these because these are both unique to OWL, and they're kind of unique to the microcontroller world. We're looking at how we store objects and how we allow users to call C functions. Both of these are things that desktop interpreters have to do, but because we're in a constrained environment, we do them very differently from what desktop interpreters do. So let's take a slightly blurry look at how OWL is used today. So you do all your development on a normal desktop computer. It's just a normal suite of Python programs that runs on Windows or Linux. And you connect to your target over USB. On the desktop, you type a command, you type a statement. It's compiled down into Python bytecodes, sent down to the controller, in this case a little robot, where it's executed and the result comes back. So I've shown here that we can, you know, define a variable, do math on it, define a function, call it, call peripherals. I turned on that little light right there. It's all very dramatic. And it all just sort of works. So let's take a look at what the compiler does. So here's a very, very simple piece of Python source code. All it does is define some variables. The first line assigns a string to the name A, and the second line takes a Python tuple. These are used all over the place, and they're fixed length arrays of Python objects. In this case, contains an integer and a string. So the compiler takes this, parses it, and compiles it into bytecodes. Now, these bytecodes don't completely represent that first line there, because we need to know what these constants are. They're not contained inline in the sequence of bytecodes. So we have a table of constants. In this case, the first constant was the first object we were assigning to a name. It was the word foo. And then the second constant was that Python tuple. So how does this actually get executed? Well, normally on the desktop, on a normal Python interpreter, before I can execute the bytecodes, I have to read all the data out of this file. So I come to the first constant, I allocate some space in memory for it, I fill in object headers, I copy the string into the object, and then I'm done with this object. The next one's a little trickier. It's a compound object. The first thing I need to do is I need to allocate space for its constituent sub-objects. Then I allocate space for the collection itself. And the collection itself just has space for two pointers. I fill in those pointers back to the objects I just initialized, and there I go. Now I can execute the bytecodes because they can refer to the objects I've just loaded. This is how basically every desktop interpreter works. This is how the JVM works. Those intermediate files that contain bytecodes and objects, well, Python calls those PYC files, Java calls them .class files. They're loaded, then they execute the bytecodes. This makes a lot of sense on a normal x86 machine. The number of constants is relatively small compared to the overall memory space we have, so we can afford to copy everything out. And having things in this intermediate state is really useful because I can define one format for the intermediate file, and that's the output of the compiler, and then I can take the output of any compiler and run it on any virtual machine. This is a disaster on the microcontroller. I don't have room to copy anything. Flash is very sparse. I have to store these objects somewhere to start with. I really can't afford to copy them anywhere. So what we do is we take a little bit different approach. Instead of storing objects in an intermediate form, we store them exactly as they would be used by the virtual machine at runtime. So if I instantiate an integer by my application, well, that goes into the heap with a particular format. It's got object headers, it's in a particular byte order, it's padded to a certain minimum size for the compiler. All of these things we do in our memory images. So our intermediate format that the compiler outputs is exactly the format that an object will be used at runtime. So the virtual machine, well, it can use these objects directly. This is relatively easy for things like integers and strings and floating point numbers, but how are we going to represent that tuple? We can't put pointers in it because we don't know where things are going to point at runtime. We don't know the memory space layout of the target device. So instead of storing tuples as a collection of pointers, we store tuples as a collection of memory objects themselves. In effect, a tuple becomes a container. In this case, it contains two memory images, an integer and a string. It could contain other packed tuples to have nested objects. So for objects that are emitted by the compiler, these constant objects that are stored in Flash, we use these packed tuples. We do a similar thing for code objects, which are themselves compound objects, and this enables all of the objects that are generated by the compiler to be transplantable. We can generate them by the compiler, we can load them onto the device in Flash, point directly at them by dynamic objects on the heap, we can copy them into heap, we can copy them around, we can even move them to another device. And all of the data is still intact. We don't have any pointers to fix up, which means that we can keep these objects in read-only memory, which we have a little bit more of. So the two currently available interpreters on a chip, Elua and Python on a chip, they both use an intermediate format. They both store data that needs to be copied from Flash into another format in memory. We don't do that. By not doing that, we can lead all of the constant data in Flash and never copy it into memory. For the majority of our applications, we found that this reduces the amount of SRAM that we need by a factor of 4. So we think that a technique that does not use a dynamic loader is absolutely critical on an embedded device. All right, so I said that we'd build our toaster in Python, but that'd be nice. It'd be nice to build our toaster in a high-level language. Things would be easier. But unfortunately, we can't get away with not using C. And the main reason for this is the vendors of these chips provide a peripheral I/O library. And really, the only way to get at the giant collection of peripherals, things like serial ports and I/O and A to D and D to A, and just these things have a wealth of peripherals. And the only way to use them is to use the peripheral I/O library. Those are written in C. So we need to have a way for the Python programmer to call these libraries if they want to be able to build a complicated system. OWL contains two ways of doing this. They both take a C header file, parse them, and expose all of the functions in that header file to the user. These two techniques have trade-offs in both speed and performance, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So the reason that a user can't just call something from their program is by using an interpreter, the programmer doesn't have direct control over the program counter on the chip. That's by design. We don't want them to be jumping off into la-la land. We want to protect them from themselves, in a sense. So we're stuck in this interpreter loop, where we load a bytecode, execute it, load the next bytecode, and execute that. We need to give the programmer some way out of this loop. So what's generally done is you modify the bytecode that implements the way to call a function. In this case, it's the creatively named call function bytecode. And this bytecode is called when a user wants to call another Python function. Generally, what it does is it sets up a frame on the stack. It changes the instruction pointer to point to the data for the new function and executes that. We modify it a little bit. When the user calls the call function bytecode, we check to see, hey, are you trying to call this magic function that's supposed to initialize the serial port? In this case, the function uart init. If you are, I'm going to direct program flow into this call uart init function that we'll look at in a minute. So I can do this for one or two or a great number of different functions that we want to expose, a great number of sort of magic functions that we want the user to be able to call. Obviously, this is all factored out differently. I've just put it in one screen for convenience. But we have hundreds of these in deployment versions of OWL. So what does the call your init function need to do? Well, we have a Python stack. It contains the arguments that we want to pass to the C function. Those arguments are Python objects. The first thing we need to do is we retrieve them from the stack. We check to see that we had the right number of them. We pull them off the stack. We convert them from Python integers into, in this case, unsigned 32-bit integer. And then finally, we can actually make the call to the native function right here. If that function were to return a value, we'd convert it back into a Python object, put object headers on it, and allocate memory into the heap, and we'd return control flow to the interpreter loop. This enables a user to call a Python, from a Python context, to call a C function exactly as if it were a Python function. For example, in this genuine piece of code that I pulled out of a project we've been building, this function drives some I/O outputs. It's all written in Python. We're defining a class here. We're looking up some variables. But these three functions, they're C functions. These were functions defined by the vendor. And you call them exactly as defined in the big giant 1,000-page manual that comes with the chip. In this case, you set the GPIO type to be a GPIO output, and we write some values to it. So how do we get these wrappers? Well, we could go through and we could write them all. We could write this for each and every single one of the functions that we want to expose. And this is the technique that both Python on a chip and eLua take. This gets to be really, really tedious when you're a small research group and you're trying to expose like 1,000 functions. So we built a tool that takes the C header file and generates a whole slew of these wrappers. This is similar to what the SWIG tool does on desktop interpreters. This approach is relatively simple. It works for any compiler on any architecture, and it results in the same code emitted over and over and over again, because we're converting these results and these results and the parameters for every single function we want to call. So let's factor all of that code out. We can factor all that code out with the foreign function interface. These things exist. They're open source. There's an open source foreign function interface called libffi. And what it does is it implements the calling convention of a particular chip. So I hand it a function pointer and some representation of the signature of that function. It puts all the stuff on the C stack, calls the function, jumps into it, waits for it to return, converts the arguments. So that's effectively what we were trying to do with our wrappers. We amended the foreign function interface to do all the conversion between Python objects and C arguments. And we can use, and we did a custom port to the Cortex-M3, which is the architecture that we're trying to target. Now, we use the foreign function interface a little bit differently from people on the desktop. Normally, people on the desktop take a shared library. They load it dynamically and then make calls into the shared library. That gives you all kinds of advantages. You know the names of the functions in that shared library. They're all in the headers there. They're all in the debugging header specifically. So I can just do that, and it's easy. On the microcontroller, we don't have that advantage. There are no shared objects. There are no shared libraries. There are no debugging headers. We don't have room for them. So instead of using the debugging headers at runtime, we've modified the foreign function interface to use information collected ahead of time from the compiler and from header files to know the signature and address of functions at runtime. That's all detailed out into the code. So let's see how these two approaches compare. The size of our programs is really, really important on a microcontroller. We don't have a lot of storage. So we wanted to visualize how big our interpreter is. We built a tool that does that, and here's the output of it. So the top line, the top bar in blue and green there, that's a visual representation of our virtual machine. That's what needs to be stored in flash. The first chunk there shows that the core virtual machine, the interpreter and the definitions of all the Python types, they take up 35 kilobytes. When we add the foreign function interface, things are a little bit more complex. That grows to 36.5 kilobytes. But this section over here, this libc section, that's where the C portions of the library, all of those wrappers that we had with the autowrap functions, those went there, and they took up about 22 kilobytes. When we use a foreign function interface, we need to store a little bit more data about the functions in Python, but we don't need those wrappers. Overall, using the foreign function interface saved about 19 kilobytes, which is pretty significant on these devices. Now, using the foreign function interface means that things are a little bit slower. We need to make a lot more function calls. With the wrapper, everything's inlined, everything's straightforward. We don't need to make a whole bunch of assembly calls or anything like that. Things are simpler, and they end up being faster, about twice as fast. We found that in real applications, that doesn't matter so much, because the actual time to call the function is kind of lost in the noise compared to the time to do other things. So you're probably wondering, can we actually do anything with it? The answer is a pretty unequivocal yes. We've taken this remote-controlled car, and we've ripped the radio out of it, put a rangefinder in the front, and GPS at the top, and a gyro on it. It's avoiding obstacles. It's avoiding lab mates. And if it were outside and could see the sky, it could navigate from one point to another, doing all sorts of cool and fancy things. It's running in a control loop to go straight, a PID control loop with the gyro. This is all pretty hard to do in an embedded system, but a sophomore with no previous experience with embedded systems did all of this in about a semester with no help from anyone who'd really done embedded systems. We're computer architects. We're not embedded systems experts, or weren't before we started this. But we've made all this relatively easy, and you can actually build things with it. It works. Right now, you can build an autonomous car. We've built an enormous amount of toys with it. This is a little digital pet thing that another student built. Some other faculty at Rice built a programmable robot, and we taught a course to freshmen. Not freshman computer science majors, just freshmen who might be interested in engineering. No one who had ever written a line of code. A lot of them had never even used a text editor. But in about a week, they were programming this little autonomous robot. Programming this autonomous robot in C with someone with no experience in programming and didn't know what a text editor was, that had been impossible. I have a barbecue at home that runs OWL. You know, when you're building hammers, everything looks like a nail. I think microcontrollers are a really interesting focus for research. We've presented two innovations to microcontroller runtime here. There are a whole lot more in the paper, and we think in the near future there will be even more. We need to compare this against other traditional development systems, but doing that is hard, and we don't quite know how to do it yet. We want to compare this to C development practices. How does the user, how does the programmer experience programming things in a higher level language? What's easier? What's harder? How do people program things in C? Do we need lots of libraries? We program things with classes and objects, and most people don't do that in embedded systems. How does that impact developer productivity? We also think this is a really important area for research. We've done a lot of research as a community in big systems. We've made supercomputers relatively tractable to program. We have great system software there. We can build giant things on data centers, but we're all stuck in the 1970s on microcontrollers. Our airplanes are built with hand-coded interrupt service routines. That scares me. It should scare you. So these systems are just becoming more and more complicated, and we need to reverse that trend, and I think we really can. We hope to make an open source release of OWL in the next few months, sometime in the fall. We have some licensing issues with our vendor right now, but we're working those out. If you want to know more about OWL and where you can get it in the future, email me, embeddedowl@gmail.com, or come pester me for questions now.
Hi, I'm Jorge Suris from BlackBerry Technologies. So I often find myself doing a lot of embedded development, and we find the need to tell time. And the way we currently do that is we count interrupts, sure. And we use global variables to do that.
Sure.
Now my question is, were you able to import a time library for Python or a way to look at global variables so that I could easily from Python see that counter go by and tell how much time has gone by?
So yeah, obviously with real-time systems, time is really, really important. And that's actually one of the first things we did. The system has a global knowledge of milliseconds since start. And there are hardware timers down on the chip, which enable us to give high-resolution timer support down to the user. So yes, you can make function calls into the virtual machine itself to figure out what time it is. And you can make function calls to time high-resolution events.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm Rick Farrow. So I'm interested in something you said near the end of your talk, that there's too many peripherals. And I'm assuming what you mean by that.
I didn't say there
were
too many peripherals. I said there were a lot of peripherals.
Okay. Well, okay. But what I'm imagining you mean here is that each one of them has to be handled in a special way.
That's correct.
And this is why you talked about the 1,000 pages of documentation.
Yeah. I was underestimating. But
okay, so you said you wanted to do something. What are you going to do with that?
Well, so generally the way these things are programmed is you take the microcontroller, you wire it to some peripheral. Now, normally I need to write a program, I compile it, I flash it down to the microcontroller, I see if it worked. It almost certainly didn't.
Excuse me, yeah.
Then I need to repeat this process until it does work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the virtual machine gives us the ability to program things interactively. Here I have this prompt where I can type function calls and see the result immediately. Mm-hmm. This has been absolutely invaluable in figuring out how to drive these peripherals. Mm-hmm. Because I can sit there with an oscilloscope on the line between the microcontroller and my device, and I can type little function calls in. I can call into the driver library, see if it did sort of what I wanted. If it didn't, I can immediately see what it did do. Maybe it returned some other value and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
We found that this is a great way to learn how to do this. And we have a bunch of freshmen and undergraduates working for us. And they've been able to figure out how to use devices much more quickly than Scott and I have, even though we're expert embedded systems programmers now, by just playing with it.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense.
So since the documentation is almost certainly wrong, having a facility to play with it and figure it out makes this so much easier.
Thanks very much. That's clear.